Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your emails and your calls. But before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So I want to put a shout out to Ian in Australia for bringing to my attention a very nice article which appeared recently in Science, talking about a new hypothesis of how acupuncture works. First of all of these statements that I'm going to be making have been validated and established, but we've always had this problem in conventional medicine of accepting something that seems so outlandish as putting a needle in the side of the little toe on the foot and having it sharpen the eyesight. I mean, that's just too weird for most of us reductionist types. And indeed, acupuncture is action at a distance. But then again, when you stop and take a step back, everything in the body is connected to and by the nervous system. So what's so far out really about this idea of acupuncture? And the key thing that's been missing is a convincing mechanism that has receptors and has wiring that has some sort of specific anatomical locus that could be brought to conventional medicine and say, okay, here's a mechanism. Not only is it plausible, it's demonstrable, and here we go. And this mechanism is called the purinergic signaling. And effectively, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the energy currency made by your mitochondria, is also a neurotransmitter. So the hypothesis goes something like this. When a needle is inserted to the skin, ATP is released by the skin cells, the keratinocytes, which is established. And this ATP binds to specific receptors for ATP that are in the sensory nerve endings in the skin. These receptors are called P2X3 and P2X2, /3, /2, close parentheses. Yes, indeed, that's the name. The signaling message goes up through the spinal column, just with all the other afferent nerve signals, and goes into the brain where it crosses over into interneuronal pathways in the brainstem and links to motor neurons, which then feed back into the gut, the lung, the heart, and the arteries and the reproductive organs, all through the autonomic, not the voluntary, but the autonomic nervous system. And these are reflex reactions taking place in the brainstem that have been demonstrated. These are all major targets for acupuncture, those organ systems I mentioned. And these signals coming from the skin also travel to the pain centers of the cortex, where they inhibit the transmission of pain to our awareness, let's say. So all of this is an established mechanism. You can read more about this in the article. I will be posting a link in the resources section of Ask Dr. Dawn, or a PDF. I'm not sure how it's going up there. And either way, it'll be something that you can take a look at. I know I have many people who are interested in acupuncture, and most of my listeners know that I practice that as part of my regular primary care medical practice, and I find it extraordinarily useful for lots of problems like irritable bowel, low back pain, headache, TMJ, carpal tunnel, neuropathy, Morton's neuroma, lots and lots of things respond well. Shout out to Joni from Aptos for bringing to my attention an article, this published in the New York Times last week, and it's called The Trouble with Advanced Directives, March 13th, 2015. Author is Paula Spann, S-P-A-N, if you're going to read the article. And of course, many people have advance directives which say that they do not want heroic measures. But it is a real challenge in medicine to make sure that the people who are doing the heroic measures actually have access to that document so that you don't go with the system default. And the default position in modern medicine is do everything until it's obviously futile. And then maybe do it a little bit more just in case. That's a bad default position. We all have heard the statistic about 50% to 75% of your lifetime healthcare cost is spent in the last year of your life. We've all heard the statistics about the percentage of over-aggressive therapy done on dying patients. And of course, the devil is always in the details, but there comes a time when it's all right to stop doing things. In the case that's discussed in Paula Spann's article, a 79-year-old man who had advanced dementia and had filled out an advance directive was in a nursing home, and he had a nosebleed, which caused him to begin vomiting blood. He was sent to the emergency room. He was put on a ventilator, received transfusions, two surgical procedures, eventually got a tracheostomy because they couldn't get him off the ventilator, had a feeding tube, and then somewhere around 2 weeks after all of that was done, somebody found the advance directive in his medical chart, and everybody said, oops. Yeah, this is not what we want to see happen. So I want to introduce to you something called the POLST. This is the Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. In California, this is a document that you can download from the california.gov website, and it is normally printed on bright magenta, fluorescent pink paper and placed on the refrigerator. And the concept is that the ambulance crews, paramedics, and EMT techs are trained to check the refrigerator. And if they see one of these forms, to actually read it. The form contains several choices, one of them which is, do not take me to the hospital under any circumstances. The second one is, only take me to the hospital if I cannot be kept comfortable at home. And the third one is, do whatever you need to do to keep me alive. And it's a checkbox, essentially, but it's signed by the doctor, so it has legal power to get the ambulance crews off the hook for having to do everything. And essentially, the cascade begins as soon as you call 911. But you don't want to necessarily not be able to call 911. A lot of times you've got an older couple living alone. One of them is debilitated or dying. And that remaining spouse might need help getting that person out of bed or dealing with an emergency. They need the emergency services, but you don't want to lock it into an evacuation to the hospital and start that whole cascade of aggressive, heroic medicine. It's very hard to get off that train once it's moving. And so we just don't want to get on the train in the first place. So POLST, you can put that in a search window. And thanks again to all of my loyal listeners for their wonderful contributions to this program. There has been a trend in medicine. We talked about this a little bit last week, and it's essentially we tend to adopt new technologies very, very enthusiastically. And then maybe a year or two or five later, we start to rethink that. Well, here's a bit of rethinking that I think we need to maybe turn around what has become a commonplace practice and rethink this one pronto. And I'm talking about PIC lines. PIC stands for peripherally inserted central catheter. And essentially, it's a thin tube that's threaded through the veins, usually the veins in the arm where you would normally get a blood draw, and all the way up into the superior vena cava, so it ends near the heart, and it allows you to deliver high volumes of fluid. Also, you can put in things that would be a little bit burny and irritating to veins, but if you put them into the big river of the vena cava, they're diluted so quickly that they don't damage the blood vessel wall. In addition, PICC lines make it easy to draw blood, and anyone who's been hospitalized and bothered every 3 to 4 hours to be stuck for yet another blood draw could certainly nod their head in agreement that that's a good thing. It can also deliver chemotherapy, IV antibiotics, and liquid nutrition, and we use these all the time now. And people can go home, say for long-term antibiotics, with a PICC line. It's all good, right? And the convenience and broad and wide availability of doctors and nurses who can insert these things has made this really one of the go-to solutions in the last, call it decade, of medical therapy. Now, we've known that PICC lines can be associated with thrombosis, that's a blood clot forming on the line. These are, of course, foreign objects sitting in the bloodstream. So blood clots can occur, and these blood clots can break off, block the IV line, or worst of all, migrate to the lungs and damage, or it literally damage or destroy, little bits of lung. A University of Michigan medical school team looked at 908 hospital patients who received PICC lines at the University of Michigan Medical School between 2012 and 2013. Of these 909 hospital patients, 268, that's close to a third, developed a clot associated with their PICC line. Most of the clots occurred in the first 10 days after the PICC line went in. The team found that the smaller the PICC line, the lower the DVT risk. They found that people who were taking aspirin or statins had a lower risk, but anyone who had any kind of surgery during their stay were much more likely to get a blood clot. Also, those who had any kind of history of blood clots, naturally enough, were more likely to do this. So I think that at this point, this is very disturbing data, and what we want to do is really rethink the PICC line for our patients. Do we want to do this as our go-to? Should we screen? I think, yes, we should probably be screening for any history of blood clots and not using a PICC line in someone who might potentially have thrombophilia, which is Latin for loves to clot. And I also think that the surgical patients might be, because they're healing, their body is going to be wanting to clot more readily. Maybe we should rethink the PICC line and really be sure we need it. Unfortunately, heparin, which would seem an obvious solution to this, did not make a statistically significant difference in the outcome. So we really need to research further. But in the short term, if you're going into the hospital and you're offered a PICC line, you want to think long and hard about, maybe I'll just let them stick me. Maybe I'll just let them replace my IVs. Yes, it's unpleasant and painful, but it might be quite a bit safer, particularly if you have one of the risk factors I've mentioned. A very interesting article here about autistic and non-autistic brain differences. Functional MRI is a type of imaging that shows us what's going on metabolically in the brain. There have been some studies looking at autistic and non-autistic brains, but we haven't really had the computer power or the algorithm to process information. The brain is so complex, and researchers have come up with a new technology that they're calling brain-wide association analysis. It's essentially a computer heuristic analysis that divides the numbers are just fantastic about this. First of all, it analyzes 1,134,570,430 individual pieces of data covering 47,636 different areas of the brain. These areas are called voxels, and the connections between them. Using this, researchers are able to look at the brains of people who suffer from autism and those who do not, and have drawn some really fantastic conclusions, looking at over 1,000 brains, close to 1,000, 523 autistic people, 452 controls, And analyzing the differences between these two brains, what they've found is fascinating. Common variations have obscured this information before, but when you can make two broad generalizations about how the brains of autistic individuals are universally different from those of non-autistics. And this is in the temporal lobe visual cortex, an area that is responsible for facial processing and social behavior. This key system has reduced functionality, and it has reduced connectivity with an area called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is where emotion and social communication are processed. So essentially, an inability to recognize visual facial information and process what it tells the brain into social behavior. Obviously, this fits so very well with what we know about autism that it really makes sense. Another area was reduced cortical functional connectivity. This is a part of the parietal lobe that's implicated in spatial functioning, where you find yourself in space. And the researchers postulate that these two things, the sense of where oneself is and where you end and the environment begins, and facial expression, emotion connectivity, could be the major contributors to the symptoms of autism. And they postulate that it is the theory of mind, of me as a distinct individual, and where the rest of the world is, and how to identify objects that are like me, in other words, other people with similar emotions, versus other types of objects, and differentiate between these. So, really, really fascinating, the idea that you might be able to use this information and serially monitor therapeutic interventions in autism is obviously the next step, but I see this as really a massive, massive breakthrough. We're going to some calls now. First is Jerry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jerry. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dawn. How are you today?
Oh, just fine. How are you?
I'm real good. This isn't about me. I have a close friend from back east who just let me know that she has breast cancer. And she sent the information about it, and I don't know anything of what these things mean. And so I was wondering if I could read to you, it's very short,
sure,
about what's going on, and if you could give me more of a context for it.
All right, shoot.
She says, I have invasive ductal carcinoma with apocrine features, grade 3, as well as ductal carcinoma in situ. Axillary lymph node is positive. Skin biopsy is negative. ER-PR is negative. HER2 is positive, just in one breast. What she's planning to do is to have chemotherapy, to have a double radical, and then have radiation. Her mother had the exact same thing at her age, and her mother lived another 30 years. So what does this all mean?
Well, all right. First of all, of course, the word invasive means that the breast cancer has passed through the duct, so there's a wall. It's gotten through the wall. So the first stage of cancer in situ, which she also has another area of pre-cancer, if you will. Ductal carcinoma in situ is a cancer, but the cancer cells are still contained within the duct, so they haven't had the chance to escape into the bloodstream or escape into the lymph tissue.
Uh-huh.
So the first area has escaped, did get through, and was trapped in a lymph node, which is good in the sense that that particular cell was trapped in the lymph node. But the implication is that the lymph node may not trap all of the cancer. And so if it's gotten to a lymph node, it may have gotten anywhere.
Are there as well?
A brain, liver, bone. Those would be the big three. So it could have any capillary bed in the body, essentially, can catch a cancer. because the cancer is a cell and it's migrating. It squeezes through a capillary wall somewhere, and if it finds fertile soil, a place where it can grow, it may potentially be able to summon blood vessels to grow into the area, to feed it, and build itself a secondary tumor. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's, think about seeds, weed seeds, you know, kind of being released by from that dandelion and floating to the field next door. Sure. That's kind of what's going on.
Sure.
Now, estrogen receptors in particularly are handles that we can use to leverage tumors. So if a woman has estrogen receptor positivity, what that means is that we can use blockers of the estrogen receptor and affect the natural history of the cancer, so we can slow the cancer down.
So when she has a negative on the ER receptor,
then we don't have a break. We can't. There's no brake pedal for the cancer.
Okay.
In that department. What she does have, she does not. Well, what she doesn't have is, she doesn't have triple negative cancer. And triple negative is no estrogen receptors, no progesterones, and no HER2 new. She does have HER2 new, which is a which used to really be bad to have because it means a more aggressive cancer. But we have a drug. So now, because we have a drug called Herceptin that can attach to HER2 new and turn down the aggressiveness of the tumor, the prognosis is much, much better for her than prior to the time that this drug existed. So ideally, what you would love to have is the estrogen receptor. If you're going to have cancer, you want an estrogen receptor positive cancer. But what she does have is a good chance of long-term survival with therapy. And by the way, long-term survival is counted as 10 years. If you get out to 30, like her mother did, that I consider a cure. Now, as to the double mastectomy, there are women who have gotten double mastectomies because they had DCIS. That is definitely an overreaction. We're currently in the pendulum swing towards removing the breasts, I think a little bit too aggressively in terms of the data, because we aren't seeing that removing the breast improves survival in a lot of the women who do it. It's probably overkill. In someone who has HER2 new, that's more appropriate. In a triple negative person, that's more appropriate, I think. But the double mastectomy is controversial. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she's kind of in the gray zone of whether it's appropriate or not.
Uh-huh.
But that being said, two things that she really needs to do, advice that you can give her that will drastically improve her prospects, is no alcohol and no cigarettes.
That's not a problem.
Well, good, but those are extremely important to put out there, you know, and because the combination of alcohol and cigarettes is a 700% increase in recurrence.
Ooh.
Yeah, sevenfold. So every time I say the words breast cancer anymore, I'm going to say that sentence, because we got to get that word out.
Wow, that's huge.
Yes, it is.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jerry, and lots of support if you can, you know, keep in contact with your friend. When you do, I don't know if you're going to go out and visit, but hugs. People with cancer, other people stop touching them. It's really weird. It's totally subconscious. So what you have to do is overcome that and consciously touch.
Easy to do.
All righty. Well, good luck to you now and your friend. Bye-bye. And let's go now to an anonymous caller. So line two, anonymous caller, you're on.
Good morning, Dr. Dunn.
Good morning.
I recently had a biopsy via endoscopy and was not diagnosed with cancer, but they did find a hiatal hernia. And I'm just wanting to get an idea from you about how I should proceed from here, taking care of myself via both medication, diet, lifestyle.
Okay.
I have almost a constant acid taste in my mouth, and I've been on first Prevacid and now Omeprazole for probably 20 years.
Hmm. When they did your biopsies on the endoscopy, was there any esophagitis, itis anywhere?
Not that reported to me, no.
Okay. So get a hold of a copy of your biopsy. and look for the word ITIS. So it'll be an ending. Could be esophagitis, could be gastritis, could be duodenitis. But if there's no itis, that is good. They also are looking for precancerous changes called Barrett's esophagus, but they would have told you that, I'm sure, if it had been right. positive for that. So a hiatal hernia is a physical, well, it's literally an anatomical problem. The diaphragm, the hole in the diaphragm that the esophagus goes through has gotten stretched out, and part of the stomach has been pushed up into the chest cavity. So when you cough, when you breathe, when your diaphragm moves, you're actually squeezing the middle of the stomach, or the upper third of the stomach usually, and that tends to exert enough pressure that you pop open the valve at the top of the stomach that leads to the esophagus and squirt acid up into the esophagus. So that's what a hiatal hernia is. It's much more common in people who are overweight. So if you are overweight, weight loss is really needs to be a goal. Okay, so that's step one. If you're not overweight, then we'll just go with the other things that you should do. Lifestyle-wise, you want to avoid caffeine. You want to avoid alcohol. There are certain other things that the cigarette smoking that weaken that esophageal sphincter, and you want a strong sphincter. You want to eat upright, no recliners, no lying down for at least a couple of hours, and you would probably want to avoid tight waistbands as a general rule. Just always have kind of a loose, elastic waistband. Use elastic belts. Use suspenders, for example, if you can pull that off sartorially. Because you don't want to press on the belly, because that's just going to increase the amount of pressure on the stomach and aggravate the whole situation. Other things that can, if you've been on the Prilosec proton pump inhibitors for 20 years, you're going to have a lot of acid, extra acid-producing cells. And with the hiatal hernia, you probably are going to need to stay on the proton pump inhibitors. But you should use acid when you eat. I know it sounds paradoxical, but if you're eating and you take extra acid at the time that you eat, so betaine hydrochloride, you can buy this at health food stores, somewhere between 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams per meal, and as long as there's no itis, this won't hurt, it'll probably reduce the amount of acid taste in your mouth, because what it does is it opens up the bottom valve on the stomach, the pylorus, and helps food move through the stomach. So the less dwell time that the food has in your stomach, the less reflux you're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
You're walking around...
Betaine
hydrochloride, yeah. And like I said, it's a standard health food store item, very easy to find. I certainly would add that because you want prokinetic agents. And if you are tasting acid, well, that means that there's some acid getting up there despite your proton pump inhibitors. And like I said, you've got extra acid-producing cells. So you might want to coat the esophagus with some DGL, which is D-glyceride licorice, and I could never pronounce that right, but that will make your esophagus protected from the stuff that you're belching up, and that can be very, very useful. People who have had this condition for a long time often have sensitivities to certain foods, and it's worth getting food antibody testing and seeing what if you're highly sensitive, if you've got lots of antibodies to wheat, for example, you might consider taking those things out of your diet just because they will tend to fuel the reflux that you're experiencing. And not everybody will. It just depends on how good the integrity of the intestinal lining, how well it's held up to all of this abuse. Oh, and one other thing, B12 and calcium are poorly absorbed if you don't have any acid. So if you're going to use that betaine hydrochloride that I mentioned, that's the time to take maybe an extra B12 and a calcium pill, or calcium magnesium, maybe 50-50 ratio, because there's an association with long-term proton pump inhibitor use and osteoporosis, and dementia, and we think the dementia is related to B12 being low in those individuals.
And would that be with every meal or just daily?
Just once a day with one of your meals.
Okay, and anything with exercise either to avoid or to do besides cardio?
Well, I wouldn't do headstands or... that's probably obvious.
No problem. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, and I mean, when you're doing abdominal, I would probably do upright crunches where you're in the frame and you're lifting your knees up against gravity rather than lying flat and doing crunches. But yeah, those are pretty much it. And when you are exercising, you probably want to drink the water, give it an hour to get into your system, then do your exercise, and then drink water afterwards, but not take water while you're exercising. I think that just about covers it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your thoroughness and your help.
Well, you're very welcome. Have a great day. Bye-bye. So going to a email now from Sky in Soquel. Subject, mercury in the fog. Is this a health risk? Why or why not? Dear Dr. Don, listen to your show regularly, but since I'm in the Redwoods with very poor cell phone reception, I never even try to call in. I'm wondering about something may or may not be appropriate. What do you think about the mercury in the fog recently discovered and written about on the KUSP websites? Scientists say that the levels are too low to be a health risk, but what about accumulative effects? Don't we store such metals in our body? And if so, isn't it a health risk for those of us who live with the fog on a regular basis? So the article on our KUSP website, which you can search, if you search mercury in fog, it'll pop right up, was about Peter Weiss-Penzia, a researcher at UCSC, and his collaboration with Kenneth Cole, who is a researcher at Moss Landing Marine Lab. And effectively, they looked at fog here in the Redwoods and found that there were very high mercury levels compared to what they were finding in rainwater. And the concept here is that the ocean sediment, mercury is produced by industrial pollution, coal burning, and other sorts of industrial effluents get into the atmosphere. They rain down into the ocean. They sink to the bottom. The mercury is then organified by algae living in the ocean. It then becomes methylmercury. It updrafts in the ocean, bring it to the surface where it evaporates and gets into the air and then turns into fog. And the concentration of the mercury in the fog is due to the evaporation of the water. So it's a more concentrated mercury. It actually mainly accumulates on spider webs, and then the spider webs drop into the soil. And so, of course, food is grown in soil. And no, it's not a great deal of mercury. And it's substantially less than what a person consumes if they have even one amalgam filling in their mouth. People vary a great deal on their ability to handle mercury, both in terms of dealing with its accumulation, which all of us have to some degree in industrial culture, post-industrial culture, but also in their ability to get rid of mercury or efflux it. And I do have some individuals in my practice who just don't get rid of metal due to minor mutations in their system. So there are a few canaries out there where the fog thing could potentially be dangerous, but for the most part, it's just background, similar to background radiation. It's interesting as a story, but I don't think there are any real health concerns for most of us. By the way, if you are exposed to mercury, which, as I've already said, we all are, having probiotics in your gut actually improves your ability to get rid of that mercury rather than having it become a biological form of mercury that can then be stored in your body fat. So only the methylated mercury gets stored in body fat, and that we get from eating fish and we get from converting it in our own intestines. So take those probiotics. Another email, this from Jennifer in Boston. I'm a Long Tide podcast listener, and I want guidance on my husband's condition. He's had 3 dermatology and 2 allergy consults for his skin rash, but no one seems to find the culprit or cure for it. 10 years ago, it started with a patch on his neck every summer, and during winter it quieted down. In the past years, he's developed patches on his cheeks and now eyelids, and it's all year long. Lesions are small, pea-like red dots that develop scaliness. His last 30-patch skin test was negative, and will now have more extensive patch tests next, but he's no other rashes elsewhere. Could he have developed a food allergy at 46? He's otherwise healthy. Jennifer, I want you to have your husband try using an antifungal, an over-the-counter athlete's foot cream on his face for a couple of weeks and see if that makes a difference. I think that he may have a reaction to a harmless environmental yeast that grows on the skin and chows down on that skin oil, that sebum that we all produce. And I have seen this happen in middle-aged men a lot, and it responds very well to the antifungal. The other thing that I want to point out is there are some B vitamin deficiencies. And so if your husband drinks alcohol on a regular basis, put him on megadose B vitamins, like a B100 twice a day for a month, and see if his skin doesn't clear up, because he may have a B deficiency that one of the B vitamins, there are actually several of them, will cause this type of skin rash. And it's one of the things that dermatologists miss a lot, because they aren't thinking nutrition. Why would they be? They're dermatologists, and the skin doesn't have anything to do with nutrition, right? No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be sarcastic. It's not their fault. They didn't get taught this in medical school. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Susan in Salinas. Hello, Susan, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. My friend has just had a hip surgery, hip replacement, and about 1.5 weeks later now, she's found out that she had a staph infection. And I want to know what she can do to help her immune system fight it.
Ooh, so this is the staph infection in the hip, in the hip implant or elsewhere on her skin?
In the incision, yeah, I think.
In the incision, okay. So keep your fingers crossed that she does not develop a staph infection in the implant. And she is at risk for that. And there's not much to be done at this point except keep our fingers crossed. But I'm hoping that her infection is confined to the surface incision. And of course, once you cut into the skin, if it comes in contact with this bacteria, which of course we all carry some staph on our skin anyway, and unfortunately, when you tend to get your hip replaced, you go into the hospital where there are very sophisticated drug-resistant forms of staph. So do you know whether she has the drug-resistant staph or the other one?
No, I don't know. It's just that he said he has to check her out, take another culture and check her on Monday.
Okay, and so they may not know yet. In any event, if she... Let's hope that it's the one that she can take the regular drugs for. And... what she needs to be doing for her immune system right now is lots of fermented foods and probiotics, because the oral antibiotics are going to mess up her gut flora. And so you can support your gut flora. Typically when people are on, she might be on something like Keflex, which is cephalexin. It's a 4-time-a-day antibiotic. So you want to take a probiotic. Ideally, you want to take that probiotic in the middle of the night. So if she gets up in the middle of the night to pee, and she can take a couple of, say, 50 billion with a B probiotic organisms at that time, that would be ideal. Otherwise, you want to try to take it at least an hour before or after the antibiotic. And the idea is that you're reseeding the intestines and modulating the immune system. And these are both very positive things to be doing while you're taking the antibiotics, and then maybe for a week or so afterwards. And this is true whether the antibiotics are given orally or intravenously, that they do mess with your gut microbiome, which we now understand is pivotal to health.
Okay. And you said fermented foods?
Sauerkraut, yogurt, yeah, things like that, because those also contain high doses of probiotic. 8 ounces of a yogurt with live cultures contains 10 billion organisms. And sauerkraut is even stronger. Sauerkraut is absurdly simple to make. You take cabbage, you chop it up, you rub salt into it, and you put it in a pot and cover the pot with a baggie full of water. And make sure no air gets to it. And in 2 weeks, you have sauerkraut. It's just the most absurdly simple thing in the world to make.
Okay.
All right.
And things like miso as well?
Things like?
Miso, Japanese
miso. Oh, miso. Miso is a fermented food product that also contains some bacteria. I don't actually know which bacteria are in miso, but I would certainly say it probably wouldn't hurt.
Okay, but yogurt and sauerkraut. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Let's go to CB in Felton. Hello, CB.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello. I'm a 60-year-old person who was 59 last year and able to run 10 miles, no problem, in very good shape. And I got a streptococcus, drug-resistant streptococcus from a routine test at Dominican and had to have a PICC line.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I had to have two because the first one failed, for whatever that means.
Well, it could mean it clotted off, or it could mean that, you know, it didn't get into the right place. I'm not sure.
It did clot off. In fact, it cost me a heart valve.
Oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry.
And I had to have my spleen removed because of the strep was pretty obvious that I got it from the test because it caused immediate bruising that spread, and mm-hmm. then it covered half my body.
Yep. This is...
And, right.
And they, you know, this is a complication.
And they kept on offering me painkillers. I saw the doctor 6 times, but different doctors each time, you know.
Mm.
And each time they said, well, I saw you had an MRI, because it was during the contrast thing of the MRI that I got it. You must have a bad back. I was hit by a car as a pedestrian 4 years before that. And
First of all, I still haven't heard your question, but let me recap so that I make sure I've heard the backstory first. So you had an injury, motor vehicle accident. You were hit. You were injured 4 years ago. You were in the hospital for a test, an MRI for that involved an intravenous injection. With contrast, and at that time you got infected with
I got a lot of bruising that didn't go away but spread.
Okay, so you had bruising but at some point you had an infection.
I noticed my health was declining over the week.
All right.
And I started throwing up a lot.
Okay,
and
now
I kept on saying, they kept on offering me pain medication, which I didn't want.
Okay, so what is your question?
It wasn't an issue, the throwing up was.
Okay, what is your question?
And I also wanted them to pay attention to
What is your question? Because hearing all of the bad things that happened, I'm really sorry about this, but this is in the past.
But the PICC line is what I want to talk about.
Go for it. What would you like to say about that?
Well, I got this PICC line. They put in a PICC line when I first was. I finally ended up checking myself into the emergency.
Okay, ma'am. Listen, you're giving us too much information here. I need you to ask the question.
The question is why are these PICC lines are put in, which are incredibly painful to install, by
mm-hmm.
the way.
Yep.
And this first one failed, and then I had my spleen removed, and they put in another one. And I couldn't even straighten my head because mm-hmm. I was extremely ill. And then, of course, I found out I lost the heart valve.
Right.
And I actually discharged myself out of the hospital myself because none of their antibiotics were working, and
okay.
I was
Okay, so the question is, you know, I think more, it's not really a question. I think what you're expressing is how many complications that can occur in the course of what starts out as a fairly routine procedure and then goes bad, and then because it's an unusual complication, it doesn't get picked up. And the fact that you saw six different doctors is, and there wasn't that continuity, whereas, you know, the cool thing about having your own primary care doctor is if you see the same person, if you try something and then the person comes back because it didn't work, then you go, wait, this is not the usual thing. I've got to step back and think again. And if it's the first time each doctor's seen you, you don't get that, and that error trapping, and that's unfortunate.
Well, unfortunately, it happened during summer, and my primary care doctor was on vacation, so the clinic...
Exactly. So that's, you know, that, and it just sounds like it's been a perfect storm for you, and I'm very, very sorry for your experience. But I'm glad you called in, because it does speak to the problem of how these things can kind of get out of control and cascade into a series of medical complications that eventually leads to damaged heart valve, loss of the spleen. Some of that's probably from the infection, but then again, why did you have the infection in the first place? And then the PICC lines, we were talking about how they can clot off and how they can contribute to blood clots going to the lungs. And I mean, you've just had a heck of a time. And
the second PICC line, and then to make things worse, because I didn't do what Dominican recommended, which is check myself into a nursing home and sign over my house to them. I instead went at home and, with the help of my daughter, did 5 weeks of Rocephin at home, mm-hmm. Which did finally brought the infection down to a point that I could live.
Right. So I think where I would finish us off here is just to say that the old-fashioned butt shot every day of Rocephin, which works and is painful and tedious, and, you know, you can also hit the sciatic nerve when you do a butt shot, and if a person isn't medically trained, that increases the probability, so there's liability at that end too. But an IV, you know, that needs to be changed every 3 days. So if you try to do this with regular peripheral IVs instead of PICC lines, somebody's going out and doing an IV start every 3 days. Well, you can that stinks, but maybe, and that's why everybody switched to the PICC lines. So really, to answer the underlying question, you know, why did I get a PICC line? You got a PICC line because it made sense to do it rather than have you complain about having to get an IV start every 3 days. And I mean, yes, naturally, you're aggrieved. You had, you know, just a terrible cascade of events. And, you know, I'm so glad that you got through it. And I hope that you'll get back your energy, you know, that you'll be able to regain your health and vigor. And it may take time, but don't give up hope and keep exercising a little bit more every day. And the other thing that you need to do, and this is not about, you know, blame, okay? This is about bad things happening to you. And everybody all the way through was probably doing the very best they could, and it still went south. It doesn't mean that anybody was wrong or anybody was bad, or even that the system didn't function exactly as the system is supposed to function. But things don't always work out the way they should. But we have to regroup. We have to try to heal it. We have to kind of try to come back. So releasing all that anger that I'm hearing from you is also a step in your healing. So thank you very much for the call and for sharing that with us. Okay, this is an email from Debbie. I am 60 and recently had the shingles vaccine. Surprisingly, I believe I had an adverse reaction. Fatigue, ringing in my ears, lightheadedness, a general feeling of all over sickness. That was 3 weeks ago. I have good days and bad days, but I'd like to feel normal again soon and get back to my regular activities. My acupuncturist recommended I try rhodiola rosea. 100 milligrams. I'm intrigued with what I've been reading about this supplement. He told me to take it half an hour before breakfast. As a member of Consumer Lab, I do not see that they have reviewed this supplement yet. I also take levothyroxine before breakfast, and I'm wondering if the rhodiola might interfere. Do you have an opinion on this supplement as well? So first of all, anyone who takes thyroid hormone, you have to take it on an empty stomach, just with water, no coffee, no food, and no other pills. And you need to give it at least a half an hour to absorb before you take anything else. So as far as taking it a half an hour before breakfast, you'd have to take your levothyroxine and another half an hour before that. So I don't know. May not work for you to take it then. I do think it would be okay to take between breakfast and lunch, and you'd probably still get very good absorption. I use a lot of rhodiola. It is an adrenal adaptogen. That means it helps the adrenal glands. The ringing in your ears, the lightheadedness, the general malaise, these could be signs of problems with the adrenal glands. And I don't know your backstory, but when you tell me these symptoms in the wake of a shingles vaccine, I'm much more inclined to see it as a vaccine-related immune reaction. So essentially, we gave you a live piece of herpes zoster, attenuated, but live virus, and your immune system reacted to it with a cytokine release. And the cytokines make you feel lightheaded, give you malaise, fatigue, and ringing in the ears is certainly, you know, in the mix as a possibility. So I expect that you will get, this will damp down on its own, regardless of whether you use rhodiola or not. And I don't feel like I would necessarily go to that herb myself, but your acupuncturist may know you a little bit better than I do. In fact, I think that's pretty likely. I do think it's a good supplement. In terms of Consumer Lab, I've kind of, the bloom is off the rose for me and Consumer Lab, because I recently learned that Consumer Lab no longer makes its income from subscriptions from people like yourself. Their major income is now coming from the fees that they charge the companies whose herbs and supplements they review, which feels to me like a conflict of interest. If you don't pay them their fee, they will not review your supplement, which doesn't necessarily mean your supplement is bad. It just means that it didn't get reviewed. So the subscriber to Consumer Lab will tend to go with a supplement that has been reviewed. Like I said, strikes me as a conflict of interest. I joined up with that organization many years ago when their primary funding came from the subscribers. Now I think they're making more money, but I don't particularly like the way they're doing it, and I no longer use them as a resource. Instead, I look at independent entities that basically exist to review products. And yes, there's always a potential for conflict of interest there as well. But if you've got three different independent accreditation entities, particularly if the Australians are involved and they've accredited it, I generally feel that that's as good as it's going to get. Do I want more FDA oversight? No, given what FDA oversight looks like, I'm not eager to see that happen with herbs, unfortunately. But I don't want to get into that right now. This other email from June in Carmel. I've had anemia for about 5 years, on and off. Last CBC showed I've slipped a little. Truth be told, I had in the last year stopped taking iron daily and continued only 2 to 3 times a week, so I'm back to taking daily. Could you advise the best source of iron, highest elemental source? I'm thinking it might be fumarate. Yes, you're right, June. Ferrous fumarate is the most concentrated form of iron. More info for you. I'm a senior, 83 years young. If that makes a difference, your help would be appreciated. My doc hasn't a clue. You're my second opinion on everything. Okay, June. I think you might be vitamin C deficient. You cannot use iron to make blood if you're vitamin C deficient. Your body cannot mobilize the iron and use it. And this is a common reason for quote-unquote iron-resistant anemia. You want to get real natural vitamin C, not just ascorbic acid supplements. So I would go out and get rose hips powder. Other food sources of vitamin C. In fact, the best source of vitamin C in gram for gram is red and yellow bell peppers, but kale and guava fruit also have very high levels of vitamin C. So you want to get natural vitamin C, at least 500 milligrams. So that's where the rose hips powder comes in. That's the most efficient way to do that. And that plus your iron, I think, will make a difference for your anemia pronto. So I hope I'm right on that. Please give it a try and let me know. And also, anyone your age with anemia needs to have had a colonoscopy, a very thorough one, to make sure that they don't have a little small colon cancer sitting down there that is intermittently bleeding and creating their anemia. One last quick item for everybody out there is that coming up on the horizon very shortly, we will have a blood test for osteoarthritis. It's going to look at something called citrullinated proteins. This test is actually available for rheumatoid arthritis, but if you look at three biomarkers, citrullinated proteins, antibodies to citrullinated proteins, and bone-derived hydroxyproline, that tells you that that arthritis is osteoarthritis, not rheumatoid. So coming to a lab near you soon, new test for osteo. I hope you've enjoyed this program as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.